Turn to the prophet Habakkuk. We'll read up to chapter 2, verse 3 this morning. The oracle that Habakkuk the prophet received, and his first complaint. How long, O Lord, must I call for help, but you do not listen? Or cry out to you violence, but you do not save? Why do you make me look at injustice? Why do you tolerate wrong? Destruction and violence are before me, there is strife and conflict abounds. Therefore the law is paralyzed and justice never prevails. The wicked hem in the righteous so that justice is perverted. The Lord's answer is this: look at the nations and watch and be utterly amazed. For I am going to do something in your days that you would not believe even if you were told. I am raising up the Babylonians, that ruthless and impetuous people who sweep across the whole earth to seize dwelling places not their own. They are a feared and dreaded people. They are a law to themselves and promote their own honor. Their horses are swifter than leopards, fiercer than wolves at dusk. Their cavalry gallops headlong, their horsemen come from afar. They fly like a vulture, swooping to devour. They all come bent on violence. Their hordes advance like a desert wind and gather prisoners like sand. They deride kings and scoff at rulers. They laugh at all fortified cities. They build earthen ramps and capture them. Then they sweep past like the wind and go on. Guilty men whose own strength is their God. Habakkuk can't take that, and so he says, O Lord, are you not from everlasting? My God, my Holy One, we will not die. O Lord, you have appointed them to execute judgment, O rock. You have ordained them to punish. Your eyes are too pure to look on evil. You cannot tolerate wrong. Why then do you tolerate the treacherous? Why are you silent while the wicked swallow up those more righteous than themselves? You have made men like fish in the sea, like sea creatures that have no ruler. The wicked foe pulls all of them up with hooks. He catches them in his net. He gathers them in his dragnet. And so he rejoices and is glad. Therefore he sacrifices to his net and burns incense to his dragnet. For by his net he lives in luxury and enjoys the choicest food. Is he to keep on emptying his net, destroying nations without mercy? I will stand at my watch and station myself on the ramparts. I will look to see what he will say to me and what answer I am to give to this complaint. Then the Lord replied, write down the revelation and make it plain on tablets so that a herald may run with it. For the revelation awaits an appointed time. It speaks of the end and will not prove false. Though it linger, wait for it. It will certainly come and will not delay. For 3 years, my wife and I were in the Royal Air Force. I was a chaplain, a sky pilot. And I was what was known as the odd bod chaplain, the OD chaplain, which means the other denominations. And what happened was, when a new intake of men came into the RAF, the Church of England grabbed about 80% of them, the Roman Catholics got quite a portion of what was left, and the ragtag and bobtail came to me. So I was chaplain to Methodists, Baptists, Presbyterians, Congregational, Salvation Army, Brethren, Quakers, Muslims, Hindus, agnostics, atheists, the lot. And whenever a man arrived with his new card for the chaplain to sign, and I noticed in the top right-hand corner that he'd registered as an atheist, not many used to, but when a man did, there were three things I always had to say to him. First of all, I said, look, I want to shake your hand. You've got more faith than I have. I really believe that it takes more faith to believe that nothing turned into something by chance, and that something became all that there is now, again by chance. That takes more faith than I've got. So I used to congratulate him on his faith. The second thing, as his chaplain, I promised him that if he died in active service under my care, which was a possibility in that theater, that I would promise him that I would bury him without a single prayer, without any hymns, without any reading from the Bible. I made him that solemn promise. I will announce to the mourners that you are dead, finished, and there is no God and no heaven, nothing at all. It's amazing how many atheists get shaken by that, you know. It's all right living as one, but dying as one is a very different matter. But the third thing I used to say to them was this: now sit down and tell me what kind of a God you don't believe in. And usually at the end of that I could say, let's shake on it, I'm an atheist too. I don't believe in that kind of a God either. Never condemn an atheist until you find out what kind of a God he was told to believe in. It's not whether you believe in God that matters. It's what kind of a God you do or don't believe in. That's what matters. I don't really care whether you say, I believe in God. My question would be, what kind of a God do you believe in? There were two men on the bridge of a ship crossing the Atlantic on a beautiful moonlit night, stars out, calm sea, and one man on the bridge, I think it was the captain, no, somebody said to the captain, you know, it's easy to believe in God on a night like this. And the captain replied, yes, I believe in a God on a night like this, a God who's as cold as that sea and as far away as those stars. Now, I want to add to something I said yesterday, to try and explain the apparent contradiction between what I said, which was that the majority of this people, of the people of this land, are now operating without a God framework, without an awareness of God. How do I find that compatible with the latest Gallup poll, which found that 62% of the people of this country believe in God? And you may have seen figures similar. Well, the answer lies in the kind of God they believe in. Because the real problem is not atheism. There are very few atheists, and when I meet a genuine one, I find he's quite an easy man to talk to. He has thought things through. He's prepared to argue. There are other positions which are more dangerous. In the program Any Questions on Saturday that I referred to yesterday, one man spoke with almost religious fervor. He was the only atheist on the team, John Mortimer, and he really spoke with religious fervor. He used the word of himself. He said, I'm a really religious man. I don't believe in God. I don't think there is a God, but I'm a really religious man. This is my faith, and this is my religion that I live by. But the others, for the most part, belong to a philosophy called agnosticism, which simply means, I don't know. And I have the feeling that nowadays it also means, I don't care either. But there is an even more dangerous philosophy around. Atheism says there isn't a God. Agnosticism says I don't know whether there is or isn't. But there is another philosophy which I find both outside and inside the church, which is the most dangerous of all to our faith. It's a philosophy called deism. Deism. And deism believes in God, but has no relationship to him. Let me tell you what deism says. Deism says there is a God somewhere. There's an old man upstairs somewhere who made all this, who created it all, but who no longer controls it, who has nothing to do with it now. He's a long, long way away, and we've got to live without him, and we've got to get on to the best of our ability with life as it is. God may exist, but he's not part of the scene. Now, years ago, that deism was applied to nature, and people said God may have made nature, but now it carries on without him. It carries on according to rigid laws of cause and effect, which scientists can discover and then manipulate. But God is no longer involved in what is created. Therefore, miracles cannot happen, because nature operates without God, and God can't do anything in nature. He's away up there. And Charles Darwin was a deist. He believed in God. He mentions God on the last page of his book, Origin of Species. But it's a God who made it all and wound it all up and then left it to operate without him. In our day, the deism that has gripped people inside as well as outside church has not only ruled God out of nature, even though God made nature, but rules God out of history, and says that God may have started the whole of history off, but now history operates without him. God is not involved. History operates according to social laws, according to political laws, according nowadays to economic laws. And therefore the task of the politician is not to seek God, but to find out the economic laws that will cure inflation and unemployment, and to manipulate those laws so that we can bring prosperity back. And our government in this country is more concerned with the economic laws than the spiritual and moral laws, yet our prosperity does not depend on the economic laws. It depends on the spiritual and moral ones. But if you're a deist, then you may believe in God. You may, like some of our politicians, go to church on Sunday. You may say prayers. You may sing hymns. But God is still away up there. He's not involved in what is happening down here. And society has to get along without him. Now, that philosophy is more dangerous than atheism. It is more dangerous than agnosticism. The philosophy of the Bible, and then I'm finished with the little lesson in philosophy, but it's right that you should know these things. And then you know what label you can apply to your own outlook on life. The philosophy of this book is called theism. And theism says God not only exists, God not only created all that is, but God is in full control of it all. He is involved with it all. He is involved with every aspect of life. He is directly involved. And his intentions and his emotions are the primary factors in what happens. And if you study nature and come to the conclusion there are certain laws of nature, those laws are nothing other than God's habits. And God can change his habits anytime he wishes. And if you discover economic laws in society, you are only discovering God's habits. And thank God he has habits. Otherwise we wouldn't be able to survive in a world when we wouldn't know what temperature water boiled at or anything. God has habits and he sticks to them. But he can also override them at any time he wishes. That is the philosophy of theism. Now, of the four philosophies I've mentioned, atheism, agnosticism, deism, and theism, it is theism that has the big problems. If you're a theist, you've got the questions. Because if I dare to say God is running England at this time, God is running the world right now, God is responsible for everything that you read about in your daily newspaper, if I say that, I've got real problems. I've got real questions. I then have to try and understand what God is doing. As I read my newspaper and read the headlines, I've got to ask, why did God let that happen? For example, if God is in control of history, then it is God who allowed the Russians into Afghanistan. Why? Why? What's he doing? Now, if I were a deist, I wouldn't have that problem. I would just say that's nothing to do with God. It just happened, and we've got to cope with it and try and do something about it. But if God is actually in charge, if it's right that Jesus is now in the control room of the universe with all authority in heaven and on earth in his hands, then Jesus let the Russians into Afghanistan. We've got problems. And if you're a real theist, you've got the kind of problems that Habakkuk had. God, if you're really in charge, if you're really controlling this nation's affairs, why do you tolerate what is happening? Why do you let it go on? Now, you've no problem if God is staying up in heaven and has left us to get on with it by ourselves. But if God is actually in charge, if you're a theist, and if you believe in the Bible, you've got to be a theist, because that's the biblical outlook. Nothing happens except by the permission or authority of God and the Lord Jesus Christ. Therefore, we've got to ask this kind of question. Why do you let things go on? Why do you tolerate wrong? Why do you let the Russians into Afghanistan? Here are just two texts from the Bible, one from the Old, one from the New Testament, to give you the kind of feel of this big God of history. When you were singing the chorus yesterday morning, crowned, God of the nations, crowned, I wondered if you really realized what you were singing. I know it sounded nice, it sounded good, and it gave you a little bit of an uplift. But did you really believe that God is the God of all the nations? And that he really is in charge of all the nations, not just the church, not just Israel, but all of them? Well, here are the two texts, one from Amos, which says, did I not bring Israel up from Egypt? Now, none of you have problems with that, because there's God redeeming his people. But I wonder how many of you, you don't need to shout it out, but put your hand up if you know the next phrase in that verse. Did I not bring Israel from Egypt? Just stick your hand up if you know what comes after. I won't put you on the spot. One does. Brother from Iraq does. And about half a dozen more. The next phrase is, and did I not bring the Philistines from Crete? Now, when did you last hear a preacher mention that? We've all heard about preachers who bring the Israelites over the Jordan into the Promised Land, but when did they mention that at the same time, into the same land, God brought the Philistines from Crete? What on earth do you think you're doing, God? You bring your people into the land flowing with milk and honey, and at the same time, you bring the Philistines from Crete into the same place, and they're going to have 300 years of problems as a result. But that's the God of the Bible. He's not just the God of his own people. He's the God of all peoples. He's, as Jeremiah calls him, the God of all nations, the God of all mankind. Is anything too hard for the Lord? I want you to get a really big view of God this morning, the God of all the nations, the theistic God of the Bible, the God who is in control of Britain and of America and of Russia and of China and of Iran and of Iraq and of Lebanon and of Jordan and of Israel. This is the God we're worshipping this morning. The text from the New Testament, just so that you don't think that once we move into the Christian half of the Bible, we leave this concept behind, which many Christians seem to think, that now God isn't even interested in Israel anymore, just the church. Forget it. This is what Paul says at Athens, preaching on Mars Hill. He says, from one man, he made every nation of men that they should inhabit the whole earth. And he determined the times set for them and the exact places where they should live. Now, that's a God who decides how much room in time and space every nation has. That's the God of all mankind. And it's against that background that we have the problems of asking why God doesn't do some of the things you'd expect him to, and why he does do some of the things you wouldn't expect him to do. The theist has these problems, and dear Habakkuk is a theist. And so his problem was, God, why are you doing nothing about the state of our nation? It is declining morally as it prospers materially. We've never had it so good, and yet, Lord, you've never had it so bad. And this troubles Habakkuk, and he says, how much longer can you cope with letting this happen? And that's the cry of many a heart in England that is really sensing what is happening. God, how much longer can you be patient with our country? We've had freedom from invasion for nearly 1,000 years. How much longer can we expect to escape what almost every other country in the world has experienced? How much longer? Lord, how much longer are you going to watch the foundations of our society destroyed? You know what the foundation of our society is? I can sum it up in one word: respect. When King Alfred, fact, not fiction, when King Alfred wrote the first English laws, he set at their head the Ten Commandments, and then he developed them into English law. And that has been, for all these centuries, the foundation of our social life, of our security, of all that we take for granted. And you can sum up the Ten Commandments in one word: respect. Respect. Respect for God, respect for His name, respect for His day, respect for your parents, respect for life, respect for marriage, respect for reputation, respect for property. The whole law can be summed up in that one word: respect. And when the foundations are destroyed, it's the respect that goes. And if I pick out three illustrations, just three examples, almost from random, this will help you to understand. Take respect for property. That is written into a healthy society. Thou shalt not steal. Last year, the bill for shoplifting in this country was £650 million. And that figure was a good deal less than the amount of goods stolen from the same shops by the staff employed in them. And so I go yesterday into W.H. Smith's in Aberystwyth, in this harmless little town on the west coast. And as I leave, I'm confronted with a big notice stuck on the glass door: thieves will be prosecuted. That foundation is almost destroyed in our country. Respect for marriage. This year in America, there are now more divorces than marriages. More. In this country, it's running about one divorce for every three marriages, or about every 3 1/4 at the moment. But the effect of this is appalling. It's going to last for the third and fourth generations. We're going to be generations getting over it. The harvest will be terrible. There are parts of inner cities, a borough like Newham in London, where over half the children do not know normal family life and will never have two parents to look to in the house. And the one that is missing is dead. How will they ever come to understand God as Father if they've never known one? And respect for life? It's almost too easy to raise the abortion thing, and we're almost becoming immune to it. But as I said yesterday, it means that one human being every 6 minutes is being murdered. We have already murdered more children now than lives lost during World War II. But I want to tell you something else. Some of you will remember the debate on capital punishment, and the humanists pulled the wool over our eyes. And we thought that abolishing capital punishment was motivated by a higher valuation of human life. It was nothing of the kind. It was motivated by a lower valuation. And it is no coincidence that the abolition of capital punishment led within a few years to widespread abortion. Both were due to the same movement. If you abolish capital punishment, it means you are devaluing the life of the victim. And murder becomes no more serious than theft. But to God it is in a different category altogether. And when we devalue human life, when we no longer regard a life as so sacred that if a man takes that life willfully, then he deserves to lose his own. As soon as we've devalued that, then it happens all down the line, and you must be aware that infanticide and euthanasia are already on our doorstep. And a booklet will be published this week, or was it last week, by Exit, a book advising people on how to commit suicide. Well, now, in the light of all this, we ask God, how long can you cope with this? How much longer are you going to let us get away with it? How much longer can you stand the stench of England in your nostrils? How much longer? Why aren't you dealing with it? Why aren't you doing something about it? You're in charge. You're in control of history. Why are you letting it go on? And dear Habakkuk is crying out just like that. And God comes back at Habakkuk and he says, Habakkuk, I'm glad you're arguing with me. It gives me a chance to argue with you. I encouraged you yesterday to be honest with God, but I did tell you, you won't win the argument with God. Let's see what God says to Habakkuk. What condescension of God to enter into an argument with this man, to respond to his implied rebuke and criticism. But God can take it, and God in his grace will respond to a man who will stand up to him in honesty and reality. And God says five things by way of rebuke to Habakkuk. Number one, Habakkuk, you've got tunnel vision. Your eyes may be open, but they're not wide open enough. You're not looking at the big picture. You can only see part of it, and because you're only looking at part of it, you're missing the real meaning. Habakkuk, you shouldn't just be looking at one nation. You should be watching the nations. Then you'll see what I'm doing. And if you've got tunnel vision, if you only look at your nation, if you only look at your people, if you only look at your denomination, if you only look at those immediately concerned with you, you will miss what God is doing. God paints on a big canvas. God is the God of all mankind. And to understand what he's going to do with your nation, your people, you need to understand what he's doing with all the nations. Habakkuk, watch the nations. The nations. Not just the nation, but the nations. And it is, alas, true of Christians in our nation as in any other that we can get preoccupied with looking at our own nation and lose the world view. The world view will give us God's perspective on where we are in his purposes. The second thing is, Habakkuk, you're in for a very big surprise. If you ask me about what I'm doing, then get ready to be amazed. Get ready to be shattered. And so often we have God tied in a little box and we expect his answers to fit in with our petty thinking. But get ready to be surprised if you ask God questions. Third rebuke to Habakkuk. I have planned to do something about the state of your nation in your lifetime. In your days. So stop telling me I'm doing nothing. I am going to do something and you will see it. Rebuke number four. I have not told you what I'm going to do because you wouldn't believe it anyway. Poor old Habakkuk, what a rebuke. And so often God cannot share his secrets with us because we wouldn't believe it. He can't tell us what he's going to do as he wants to. For as Amos says, God does nothing without revealing it first to his prophets. He always gives warning. He always gives notice to his people if they're listening and if they can believe it. But when he knows that they're not going to believe it, he doesn't say. And the fifth rebuke is, I've already started doing it and you've missed it. You've missed it. And now comes the real thing. Again, listening to the radio on Saturdays became a very funny statement was made, which really has tickled me pink ever since. It's a profound philosophical statement, but it really is priceless. And this is what it is. Remember, the light at the end of the tunnel may be an oncoming train. I just find that very funny indeed. That applies to so many things that have happened in my life. You know, you think at last you're getting out of it. And then suddenly, boom, and you're overwhelmed. Poor Habakkuk. He says, Lord, what are you going to do about it? He thought he was asking for a bit of light at the end of the tunnel, and it became the oncoming train. I am raising up the Babylonians. That's what I'm doing about it. To try and get the flavor of that, let me try and put it in terms that you'll understand. But I want to be very careful in the next thing I'm going to say. I am not saying this is what God is going to do. I'm only using it as an illustration. But some people have been saying that God is going to send a Russian invasion to England. I have here a Christian pamphlet which is headed the 1980 Soviet invasion, which claims to be a prophecy of God that Russian invasion of this land will take place this year. I have no witness in my spirit that that is a true prophecy. I just say that quite simply. But I use it as an illustration. Supposing it was a true prophecy, how would you feel if God revealed to us that that is how he's going to deal with Britain this year? How would you feel? You'd feel a train had run over you. That's how Habakkuk felt. I have met more than one who are convinced of this. I was with a man called Victor Sparrow. He is a Norwegian artist. He makes stained glass windows. And he was the man who got Solzhenitsyn out of Russia. And Alexander Solzhenitsyn went to stay with Victor Sparrow in Norway when he came out. And Victor Sparrow was asked to make the stained glass windows for the Arctic Cathedral in Tromsø in northern Norway, above the Arctic Circle. And he created some magnificent windows which all portray the story of the gospel of Jesus Christ. But you may have seen these windows, by the way, on TV at Easter. Last Easter there was a program about the windows. But he has painted all the figures in Russian costume. The whole style of the window is Russian art, because he says he wants the Russians to see the gospel of Christ first when they invade northern Norway. That's quite an amazing thing to do. And certainly we need to be aware that this decade could well be the decade of World War III, and that militarily speaking, there is nothing to stop the Russians until 1984. They could be in Paris in 48 hours. These are real facts. Duck them if you wish. But I am not saying this is what God is doing. I want to make that quite clear. I want you to get the feel of Habakkuk's heart. What I would dare to say, and go a little further than that, is to say this. I think in watching the communists, and in watching communism, we may well have been looking in the wrong direction. I believe it is far more likely to be Islam that God is raising up to deal with us. Far more likely. And I believe that already he has put us in the hands of the Muslim world. Financially, we are now so dependent on them. We think we've got enough oil now from the North Sea. Well, don't delude yourselves. It's not oil that has made us dependent on the Muslim world. It is the fact that if the Arabs withdrew their investments from London, and if they cancelled our export orders to their countries, we'd be absolutely on the ground. And if you knew just how much of your capital city is in Arab hands, I think you'd be shaken. So that's the God of all mankind. God, how long are you going to tolerate this little situation in our nation? Well, get a bigger view, Habakkuk. Look at the world view. See what I'm raising up. I'm raising up Babylon. You think Assyria was the threat? No, Assyria's gone. I'm raising up Babylon now. And God was under no illusions about the Babylonians. He told Habakkuk, I know exactly what they're like. They are ruthless. They are cruel. And God uses picture after picture of beasts and birds of prey like wolves and leopards and eagles. He says, I know what they do. I know they come charging into a country. They laugh at fortified cities. They build a ramp. They come in. I know what they do. They plunder property. They deport people. They are a ruthless, cruel nation. And God makes two statements about them which are pretty tough. One, I know that they are a law to themselves. They acknowledge no authority other than their own. They are a law to themselves. They are the very embodiment of lawlessness. which is to be totally a law to yourselves. Babylon has always been that. Babel always was that. Babylon throughout the Bible, from beginning to the book of Revelation, stands for men who are a law to themselves, who acknowledge no law above theirs, only their own laws. And the other thing that God says about them is that they are guilty men whose own strength is their God. Babylon wasn't the last nation to be like that. Now Habakkuk is absolutely shattered at this answer. He's been crying out to God, God, why didn't you do something? And now when God says, but I am doing something, this is what I'm doing. But God, you can't do that. Isn't it amazing how fickle we are when we argue with God? We first of all say, God, you're doing nothing. And then when he tells us what he's doing, we say, but God, you can't do that. Our little minds, we've already decided the answer to our own prayers in so many cases. We've already settled how God should act in response. We know what he should do, so we think. And then when he does what he thinks, we complain again. And dear Habakkuk plunges into a second argument with God. It's very pathetic. And yet when you look into your own heart, it's so like your own prayers. God, I pray and I pray, give me more patience. And so the Lord puts you in a really tough situation that day to give you more patience. How do you think he's going to give it to you without letting you get into a real problem? You know, somebody told me actually they'd prayed for more patience, and then the next day they'd forgotten to set the alarm. So they got up late, they had to rush breakfast, they ran to the station and saw the train just pulling out. They got to the office behind time and everything seemed to go wrong. And I just prayed for more patience and look what God did to me this next day. This was the person's reaction. But you know, God knows what he's doing. After all, he's God. And if there's one thing Habakkuk needs to remember in these early arguments with the Almighty, it is God is God. He's not the chief butler that we can just call and say, do this. He is God. It is not our place to tell him what to do. It is his place to tell us what he's going to do. But poor old Habakkuk hasn't learned this, and so he plunges into this second phase of the argument. Now he's arguing from the opposite point of view. First he says, God, you're not doing anything. Now he says, God, you shouldn't be doing this. And he builds up his argument very carefully. Let me spell it out so that you've got it. He starts from three premises, two of which are true and the third is false, but he doesn't realize that. Often we argue with God from a mixture of true and false premises, but let's look at the three premises. Premise number one, if you are an everlasting God, then you couldn't exterminate your people. Now that's a good argument, and it's true. If God is everlasting and puts his hand on a nation or a people, then the everlasting God must ensure that those people survive. That is the reason that Israel has survived to this day. Because it is an everlasting God who put his hand on them. That is the secret for their return to the school atlas after an absence of nearly 2,000 years. God's calling is irrevocable. And if God sets his hand to something, then because God is everlasting, then that something will inherit the everlastingness of God. That is why when God stepped into your life, he gave you not just a good life, not just a better life, he gave you eternal life because he's an eternal God. God cannot exterminate a nation if he's an everlasting God and has put his hand on them. And that's a good argument. And Habakkuk says, you can't bring the Babylonians. They've wiped out nation after nation. You're an everlasting God and we're your people. You couldn't let them wipe us out. Now that's a good argument. The second argument he uses is this. That a righteous God must punish. That's true. A righteous God must discipline. And so Habakkuk accepts that God needs to discipline the nation of Israel. He accepts that. Now comes his third argument, which is false. O God, you are of purer eyes than to behold iniquity. That is not true. I've heard it quoted in many prayers. I've heard it quoted by many preachers. And they've all quoted it as if it's true. But it's not true. It's something Habakkuk is saying to twist God's arm. Let's get the meaning of it first. It doesn't mean, as I used to think, that God was so pure that, in fact, when he saw something evil, he had to shut his eyes or turn his head away from it. It doesn't mean that. The word behold in Hebrew means to gaze, to stand and look at something without doing anything about it. O God, you are too pure not to have a go. You are too pure to watch something going on and not get in there and stop it. Now, we are not that pure, it's true. I'm afraid there are things that we can watch going on without doing anything about it. But Habakkuk is saying, God, I do not believe that you could stand and watch the Babylonians come and destroy our country and do nothing about it. I just don't believe you could bring yourself to do it. You are too pure. You couldn't do that. Lord, I challenge you. I defy you. You're going to bring the Babylonians? You couldn't. It's not in your nature to do that. You couldn't stand by and watch that happen to this land. But in fact, the truth was that God could stand by and watch, and that in fact, he did. We have got to come to terms with a God who is so patient that he can stand by and watch and not act, not immediately. Praise God that he is that patient. Praise God that he is that tolerant. But Habakkuk is trying to paint God as less tolerant than God actually is. And he's trying to twist his arm. And so he then goes on to say, now therefore, from my three premises, there are two things that I want to tell you, God. First, in saying you will use the Babylonians, you are using an immoral means. An immoral means. And I don't believe a moral God can do that. And secondly, I believe that you are actually going to produce an immoral end by using them. Do you know one of the most difficult things for God's people to understand is that God can use people who are not his people to teach his people a lesson. Now, do you find that easy? Let me illustrate it. Here is a young man and he comes to me. I'm quoting more than one, but let me generalize the illustration. A young man comes to me and says, I don't know whether I should marry this girl or not. He said, my parents don't agree that she's the right one for me. But then they're unbelievers. Have you heard that? They're unbelievers, so they couldn't possibly know anything about what was right for me. And so the young man had come to me asking for a Christian's advice as to whether these two were suited for marriage. And my response is, go home and listen to your parents. They may be unbelievers, but they've been round more corners than you have. And they know you well. You listen very carefully. The fact that they're unbelievers doesn't disqualify them from being a help to you. Let's take another example. People say they find difficulty understanding one of Jesus' parables in Luke 16, the parable of the unjust steward. How could the Lord use a crook, a criminal, to teach a lesson to his people? Where's the problem? It's no problem, that parable. And it's a very simple, straightforward lesson. That crook had two values right in his life. First, he valued people more than things. And second, he valued the future more than the present. And he acted on both those values. And as Jesus said, the children of darkness are often wiser in their generation than children of light. Therefore, we can learn a great deal from the children of darkness. We don't have a monopoly on shrewdness. And so we can't bear the thought that God would use somebody who's not even part of his people and somebody who's morally worse than we are to correct us. Some Christians can have this attitude when they're stopped for speeding by a policeman. He's not even a believer. We don't say this. We just sort of feel it inside, you know? And I'm nearer to God than he is, and why should he stop me for speeding? I'm sure I live a better life than he does. I'm sure I'm nearer to the Lord than he is. But the Lord has sent that policeman, along to you as a minister. A minister. That's the word used in Romans 13 of the government and the authorities. They're ministers of God. So next time you're stopped, say, I'm sorry, Reverend. You're a minister of God to me, and you've stopped me behaving dangerously to other people. Thank you. That's a different attitude, isn't it? Lord, you're going to bring the Babylonians? Don't you realize they're 10 times worse than we are? How could you watch the wicked destroy those more righteous than themselves, says Habakkuk? How could you do it? I know we're bad, and I admit we deserve punishment, but how could you use them to punish us? It's not moral. And he says the end will not be moral any more than the means. I'll tell you what will result, says Habakkuk. Don't you realize that it's like a fisherman with a net with great hooks? They simply outfish the waters. They don't leave anything behind. Where the Babylonians have fished, there are no fish left. And they even worship their nets. And they live in luxury. And they simply take everything. And wherever the Babylonians go, there's just nothing left. And the Sea of Nations is empty. And so Habakkuk says, God, you really don't know what you're doing. And then comes the little bit at the beginning of chapter 2. By the way, I'm sure you know that God never divided his word into chapters. You did know that, didn't you? I'm still waiting for a Bible to come out without chapter and verse numbers, because God didn't put them there. He never intended them to be there. It's made Bible study far too easy for us. You'd really have to know your Bible if you couldn't look up chapter and verse, wouldn't you? Really have to know it. And for 1,000 years, Christians didn't have chapter and verse. I'm told the chapter numbers were put in by men riding on horseback between Paris and Lyon. Well, that's probably not the most conducive atmosphere in which to divide God's word up. But the tragedy is that so often the chapter headings divide what God has put together. So forget figure 2, just read straight on. And Habakkuk, in his disgust with God, in his failure to understand God, in his argument with God, says, right, Lord, I'm going to get up on the walls and I'm going to watch. I dare you to bring the Babylonians. I call your bluff. Now, most commentaries I've read, indeed all of them I've read, have so spiritualized the first verse of chapter 2 that Habakkuk got into a really holy mood and wanted to be near heaven and climbed up a tower and said, Lord, I'm up here and I'm going to pray. And, you know, he was having a QT. But in fact, verse 1 is full of I will stand at my watch and station myself on the ramparts. I will look to see what he will say to me and what answer I am to give to this complaint. In other words, let's really see. Right, God, I've given you an argument. Let's see if you can cope with that one. You dare to bring the Babylonians. And I can see Habakkuk standing up there with his arms folded on the ramparts, watching the horizon. You're going to bring the Babylonians, are you? I dare you. It's a defiant attitude. It's a man who cannot accept that God knows what he's doing. It's a man standing, arguing with God. And God, bless him, just says two simple things to this angry man, Habakkuk. You're in the wrong place. You're in the wrong place. What are you doing up here? Why are you up here watching from the ramparts? Why are you not down there telling the people the Babylonians are coming? Do you think I revealed this to you so that I could satisfy your curiosity or win an argument? Do you think I told you they were coming so that you could get up on the top of your wall and defy me to do it? I did this so that you could do something about it. It's a time for action, not argument. Habakkuk, I've told your mind what I'm going to do, but now I want your will. I want you to do something about it. If I tell you what I'm going to do, it's in order that you may do something. That prophecy that came from Russia, from the godly monk Serafin, way back in 1911, notice the date, is a prophecy that many of you have heard, but I read it again. It's a remarkable one. 1911, a Russian monk. An evil will shortly take Russia, and wherever this evil comes, rivers of blood will flow. This evil will take the whole world, and wherever it goes, rivers of blood will flow because of it. It is not the Russian soul, but it is an imposition on the Russian soul. It is not an ideology or a philosophy, but a spirit from hell. In the last days, Germany will be divided in two. France will be just nothing. Italy will be judged by natural disasters. Britain will lose her empire and all her colonies, and will come to almost total ruin, but will be saved by praying women. America will feed the world, but will finally collapse. Russia and China will destroy each other. Finally, Russia will be free, and from her believers will go forth and turn many from the nations to God. That was said in 1911. And it was brought out from Russia by a dear nun, Mother Barbara, who is now in her mid-90s and who lives on the Mount of Olives. Isn't that an astonishing word? But why do you think God would tell us this? In order that we might say, we know what's going to happen, we've got the secrets, we know it all. Or in order that we might argue with God and say, God, we don't agree with this, we don't think this is the right way to do it, we don't think this is the answer, that you should evangelize the world with believers from Russia. By the way, isn't that an exciting thought? That's where God is really getting his church ready. Where the people are learning to live very close to Jesus because they're having to learn to die. And God is preparing there. Oh, when you pray for the church behind the iron curtain, don't pray in pity, I beg you. They pity us, I know that. When I went to Czechoslovakia and said, we are praying for you in England, they said, what? You praying for us? Why? We pray for you. You're in a far more serious condition than we are. God is preparing them. Pray that God will prepare them for what God is planning to do through them. It wouldn't be our plan. Our plan would be that the superior Western churches, in a patronizing way, would help these poor people behind the iron curtain along in their faith. God is looking at it another way. He's getting them ready to help us. May not suit our preconceived notions, but why should God reveal these things to us? So that we can be in the know? So that we can have something better than the astrologer can produce? No. So that we might do something about it. Habakkuk, get back down into those streets and write the message up in big letters. The Babylonians are coming. Don't stand up here and argue with me and see whether I'm going to do it. And secondly, Habakkuk, you're not only in the wrong place, you've got the wrong time too. You're going to wait some time, Habakkuk. You think I'm going to do it next Friday? It'll come. There is a time appointed for the Babylonian invasion. It will not be delayed a single day. Wait for it. If it lingers, that's not because I've forgotten or because I've changed my mind. It's because there's a time. And you know, one of the things that I think we get most wrong is that our timing is so short and God is so long. Phillips Brooks used to say that the trouble is that God, that I'm in a hurry and God isn't. I'm in a hurry and God isn't. God doesn't send his bills in every Friday evening. God takes not only the larger view, being the God of all mankind, he takes the longer view because he's the God of all history. And 1,000 years is like a day to him, and it's only been a couple of days since Jesus died to God. Habakkuk, you silly little man. Why are you standing up there arguing with me? Get down in the streets and tell them the Babylonians are coming. Tell them how to get ready. And tomorrow or Thursday morning we'll see how God told them to get ready. But you're in the wrong place at the wrong time. This is my burden for you this morning. It's a very simple burden, and it's this. God is God. He knows what he's doing. I just don't know how much longer he can be tolerant of what is happening in this land. When you consider all that God has done for our country, all that he's invested among us, he brought us the gospel of Jesus within 30 years of Jesus dying on the cross and rising again. And we've had it ever since. The first martyr for the faith was a Roman soldier called Albinus, St. Alban. He was one of those who brought us the truth to set us free. And God has put a church or a chapel building within walking distance of 97% of the population of this land, and given us more clergy than doctors per head of population, and given us so many versions of the Bible in English we hardly know which one to use. How do you think he feels now? There was a day when this country was the major exporter of the truth and sent more men and money overseas to bring the good news of Jesus than any other nation in the world. That has now passed over the Atlantic to America. How much longer will God tolerate? I believe the signs are already on the wall that God is going to deliver us into the hands of our enemies, unless we hear. And so my last word is this. God did not send the renewal to us for our sake. He did it because he still loves this country, and because he still wants to have mercy on it. He did it because he wanted to turn the church inside out, that he might turn the world upside down, or rather right way up. He did it so that he would have a body, a people, whose prime concern would not be their own prayer, their own healing, their own body, but whose prime concern would be to get up there and write it in big letters for the nation to see that God is still rich in mercy and longs to save us before it is too late. That's why he did it. And even the bookstall, I look at it, and almost every book is concerned with ourselves and our own spiritual health and welfare. There's hardly a book there about what's happening in the nation in darkest England. There's not a book there. Habakkuk, stop standing up there on the wall talking to me. Get down there and tell the people. Tell them before it's too late. And unless the renewal movement hears that and does that, then we shall finish where the Welsh revival finished, with repetitive singing. And all over the country, the renewal shows the danger of that. And while we sing our little choruses, a nation that God has loved goes down the drain. Father, may your Holy Spirit test all that I've said. May he confirm the truth of anything that has been of you, and blot out the rest from our memories. For Jesus' sake. Amen.